A podcast of the cinema.
Have you ever considered who those people singing are on that?
I figured it was probably all blue.
A little bit of music. Oh, do you think that is him doing different, like, I think processed voices?
Yeah, just like to track. I'm like, you know, multiple tracks of him doing the different.
Huh. And he just modulates himself up and down.
Blue is a multiple threat.
No, I know. I just thought about maybe there was a little choir.
No.
Maybe, no,
no. It's all just blue doing it over and over again, just doing each part. You know?
I was just sort of hoping maybe someday I would run around in town, like in the city, and just run into them.
The Linoleum Knife Choir?
Yeah.
Like they would be traveling in a pack?
The Polyphonic Spree does that. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir does that.
Yeah, and one day, you the way you always kind of run into the Mormon Tabernacle Choir at the grocery store, and they're all pushing the one cart.
It's just a thought that popped into my head. Like, who are they? Do they live here? It's probably all blue.
It's probably all blue. Your thoughts are stupid.
I don't understand technology very well.
This we know. You are Dave White.
Well, I do know.
And I'm Alonzo Duralde.
That on Positive K's I Got a Man, which is one of the great songs of the 1990s.
Uh-huh.
That's him doing the lady voice.
Well, there you go.
All pitched up. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Are you a chef? Because you're giving me soup.
So
did you tell everybody our names?
I did. And
were you good at differentiating between you and me?
I said that you were you, and that
you got
I
my
was
name
me.
Right and your name right. Okay,
yes.
I wasn't listening to what you were saying.
Of course,
saying
you
all.
Weren't. You never do. So it's awards weekend here in Los Angeles. I went to the Spirit Awards yesterday, which was a blast.
Oscar day and is my favorite day.
Why is that?
It's very much to me like Super Bowl Sunday, even, but it's a little more cozy than Super Bowl Sunday. Because Super Bowl Sunday is when you invite folks over to play board games, and I feel like I'm hosting a little bit. I don't feel like I'm hosting at all on Sunday.
So you're not saying the Oscars are the Super Bowl for you. You're saying that these are both occasions to sort of bunker down and eat
relax.
Good things. Right.
Okay. I get to relax. Like, you have taken it upon yourself to tweet the whole show.
Yes.
And I kind of sit on the couch and I'll retweet you, and maybe sometimes I'll say something. I don't know. But, like, generally, today is my day to have my pajamas on by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, make a giant bowl of spaghetti.
Yes.
And then eat it.
Yeah, no, we know a lot of friends who have to go cover the Oscars.
I don't envy those friends at all.
Me neither.
I feel especially sorry for, like, Carrie Bell, who's always on the red carpet. She enjoys it, I guess. Maybe Gray is even on the red carpet?
Quite possibly.
I don't know.
I saw a friend of the show, Leonard Maltin, yesterday. I know he's going to be covering it.
And, will Leonard be on the red carpet?
He might be.
Or will he be doing something a little fancier, maybe?
It depends. He has done the carpet in the past. He and Jesse have, like, had to work the carpet before. They might just stick him backstage. I don't know where he's going to be, but he'll be there.
We will be
in pajamas eating spaghetti, so that's going to be great.
I mean, friends come over, but, like, they, too, are just sitting around eating the spaghetti.
Right.
And because they don't care. Like, I like the red carpet. I like the red carpet more than...
The show,
because outfits are great,
right?
I want to know what they're wearing, male and female. I need to know, because tomorrow they're going to break it down on Wendy Williams,
of course, and on Fashion Police and at the Go Fuck Yourself site and everywhere else, you know, in the media.
FUG,
yes, Go Fug Yourself,
yeah.
The Fug Girls,
yes.
They're very, very funny fashion writers.
Okay, And I did a thing. Yep. Talk about the Spirit Award. Tell me what happened that was good. I'll go.
Moonlight.
I'm not interested in going to things.
Moonlight.
Like that.
Moonlight won all the things.
Good.
Which was great, and including the Robert Altman Award, which is the award they give for an ensemble cast. And that award also goes to the director of the film and the casting director of the film.
Oh.
So that freed up some of like the, say, supporting categories where they might have also won for other people. Ben Foster got supporting actor for Hell or High Water.
Oh, yeah. That's not a bad decision.
And, I mean, that's a nomination as a supporting that makes more sense than the Jeff Bridges Oscar nomination, because you could argue that Jeff Bridges is the lead in that film, I guess.
Yeah.
And supporting actress went to Molly Shannon for Other People, which is a movie that even I'm astonished at people who have been like, what is that movie? I never heard of that movie.
Right.
And yeah, it got kind of a dump release. It was day and date streaming, so it didn't get a lot of theatrical play. And if you weren't really paying attention for it, you may well have missed it. But we talked about it, and I hope now that people go, oh, Molly Shannon won an award for a movie, and I don't know this movie. I should go see that movie. It was on Netflix. I don't know if it still is.
Maybe.
But yeah, seek it out. It's worth
The movie is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
She's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking
of day and date.
Oh, and Isabelle Huppert won.
Was she there?
Yeah.
Of course she was.
Of course
there.
She was
today
there.
Today's the Oscars.
Yeah.
Of course she was at the end of Spirit.
She was in town.
Did she get up at the microphone and say, no popcorn, no drinks, no candy?
No.
Just movies.
She did not talk about that.
Silence.
But she did. No, she was great. She talked about how yes, The Independent was a good idea, and how, you know, she thanked Paul Verhoeven, who is a very independent director.
He sure
and,
is.
And Saeed Ben Said, who is the producer, who is also very independent.
Speaking of day and date. Is there anything else you would like to say? Were you fed anything particularly nice? This is obviously the most important
thing. The food was fine. We sat. It's the kind of thing where they don't have service, so like everything is already all there on the table when you sit down.
Oh,
so it's like a cold lunch.
Like room temperature.
It's a cold lunch, but it works.
Fine. Is it good though?
It was good.
What was it?
We sat down to a little like asparagus quiche with some asparagus and cherry tomatoes and kind of a dressing thing on the side.
Oh, cherry tomatoes.
Which I did not
eat. Did you shrink like Superman from Kryptonite?
No, I just left them on the plate. And then there was like sliced seasoned chicken breast with a little pesto sauce on the side.
All right.
There were skewers that had prosciutto and mozzarella balls and like cherry tomatoes and peppers.
All right.
There was a cheese plate.
Yes.
It had an olive tapenade and a white bean spread and a couple of cheeses and some different kinds of crackers.
And don't sleep on the white bean spread. That stuff is usually really good.
It was tasty, yeah. And so was the tapenade. And then the desserts, they had little mini cheesecakes with apricot. They had half dipped in chocolate biscotti. Huh. And they had these little cornflake chocolate chip cookies that were great.
Mm. I noticed you didn't bring any of those home.
I ate them all.
Why don't you stuff some in your pockets?
Isabelle
Huppert wasn't touching her. Did you go to her
table?
That's true.
I should have gone over to where the famous people
were. Go get Isabelle Huppert's cookies. Bring Isabelle Huppert's cookies home for me.
I didn't even bring
home. Some kind of husband you are.
I didn't even bring home the bourbon from our table. Robert took it.
You march right up to that woman. Is it Isabelle Huppert? I know you're not eating those cookies. You're a tiny little bird lady. I'll take those cookies.
Je demande votre biscuit.
Speaking of day and date,
uh-huh.
I've said this now three times,
yes.
Now, so I have to say something about
it. We are speaking of it, apparently, yes.
The girl with all the gifts.
Oh, right, yes.
Does anyone know what this film is?
I'm kind of shocked at how that it's getting this kind of treatment, because when it started, I mean, it played at the Locarno Festival in Switzerland, and it got really rave notices at the, I think at Fantastic Fest or one of those sort of genre-y festivals. Like, people were really talking this movie up.
Yeah.
And yeah, it opened yesterday in like four theaters nationwide or something, and it's streaming on iTunes. I was kind of shocked that that's where it wound up, but that such is the marketplace right now. You saw it. I have not gotten a chance to see it yet.
It's a victim of bad timing.
Well, yeah, I can see that.
It's directed by a guy named Colm McCarthy. He's done a lot of British television.
Yeah, Peaky Blinders.
Peaky Blinders, yeah. Screenplay adapted by the author of the novel.
Right.
A guy named Mike Carey. And it's already, I mean, it opened in England and Europe, the rest of Europe, last autumn.
Hmm.
In like September, October, November of 2016. It is only now making its way to the United States. And it is in an incredibly limited theatrical run. One theater in Los Angeles is showing it. Otherwise, it's on iTunes. So everybody, anywhere, gets to see it, which is good for them. And I suppose that's how they're going to make back their money. Or, no, they already made back their money. Anything that happens in the United States is gravy.
Well,
I'm guessing. Because it was nominated for at least a BAFTA award, and you know, it got good reviews out in the world.
The U.S. isn't gravy yet, but you know, we're not China, apparently, right, as far as like money goes. But yeah, just because you've opened in Europe doesn't necessarily mean you've
I know, been but profitable. What I'm saying is that,
but yeah, we're the afterthought.
It doesn't
on
feel
this
like
thing.
They need us, and Lionsgate certainly decided that it didn't need a theatrical
right
run for this of any note.
But explain why the timing is bad.
The timing is bad because it fuses together two genres of film that I find at this point in history
played out.
Not just played out, but actively repellent. I am bored with zombies.
Mm-hmm.
And I am more than bored, I'm fed up with the young adult novel adaptations.
Specifically the post-apocalyptic.
The post-apocalyptic YA, special yeah. kid who takes care of everybody.
Right.
That's what this is.
Yes.
But wait. This special tween who offers the possibility of salvation in the post-apocalypse is a zombie.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. I wrote about this movie. I wrote the review of this film for The Wrap. So mm-hmm. Go there. Go to therap.com. You can read me. It stars a newcomer. Her name is Senia Nanua. She'd done one little short film before this. And she's, you know, like 12, maybe. Mm-hmm. She plays a little cutest little adorablest zombie.
Little zombie girl.
And she lives in a military compound, strapped to a chair, with guns trained at her head at all times. She and all the other little zombie children. Somehow, a fungal infection has overtaken the world, wiped out most of the human population. And this batch of little zombie kids are different from the others.
They're in zombie daycare.
They are, yeah, they're in zombie daycare, but they are also, it's zombie prison for little kids.
Mm.
What this little batch of kids can do is talk. The other ones who've got, like the first wave, they just turn into grime, lesion-encrusted monsters.
Mm.
They screech and they eat. there's an explanation for the kids. They were the fetuses of people who got infected.
So they're zombabies.
They're zombabies. I don't think it's good for me to explain, to quote exactly what the film describes as how they emerged into the world, but let's just say they got out.
I hear you.
Okay. They exited the world.
You're right, yes.
And so
there's a reference to this sort of thing in the Book of Watchmen.
Yeah. So they she's, you know, she's a monster baby. She's like 12, and she's sweet and kind and loyal and patient and smart and, you know, is completely devoted to her teacher, played by Gemma Arterton,
mm-hmm.
and has a chilly but still interesting relationship with a scientist played by Glenn Close,
mm-hmm.
who walks around for the film. You know, when people get a little too attached to Melanie is the name of the little monster zombie girl.
Mm-hmm.
She says, it only presents as a child.
That's going to be my new runner-up to It Would Touch My Stuff when asked why I'm not going to have children ever. It only presents as a child.
So there's a zombie attack on the military compound. All hell breaks loose. Melanie and Gemma Arterton,
mm-hmm.
and Glenn Close and Patty Considine. As a military commander,
mm-hmm.
and a guy whose name I'm blanking on, but he was in the show Cucumber and also in that show Banana.
Right.
He's a guard, and so they all escape into the British countryside, but they're not safe because there's. You know,
it's riddled with zombies.
They call them Hungries.
Hmm.
They never say the word zombie in the movie. So they kind of are in... They have to rely on this girl to help navigate them through the zombiescape.
Right.
Yeah. So then there are some surprises in the second act. I won't tell you what they are.
Okay.
But they kind of play against what you think is going to happen.
Hmm.
And that surprised me and made me like the movie a whole lot more because the film is just as concerned with this zombie child's survival.
Mm-hmm. As with the humans.
Which means humans have to somehow figure out a way to live with this ongoing threat. And will they be able to do that?
Interesting.
Yeah.
So they have to adapt and not necessarily just quash.
Yeah.
Huh, okay.
But like I say, there are surprises. And this film is well made, and it looks really good. I think the camera work really captures that feeling of fear and melancholy and like ongoing despair that you just accept as life.
Right.
And... the script is more interested in characterization than a lot of zombie movies that you might see.
Okay. Well,
most zombie movies that you might see. Shaun of the Dead notwithstanding.
Right.
But it's about these relationships with these people and this little kid. I liked it quite a bit.
I like that Gemma Arterton. She's the Felicity Jones I like.
Yeah. Her career is weird, though.
Yeah, yeah. She either does these little kind of, you know, artsy indie movies.
Art house stuff that nobody sees.
Yeah, like...
or big blockbusters like that Gemma don't become Bovary. Blockbusters.
Yeah.
And no one sees those either.
Yeah, Prince of Persia did not do her any favors.
Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters.
Whew.
So, you know... I might tend to agree with you on her versus Felicity Jones. In fact, I think I do.
Yeah.
Because for a long time, both of them were people I would look at in the face and think, which one are you again?
They were the Dylan McDermott, Dermot Mulroney.
I know you're someone English. I know you're British.
And you weren't on Downton Abbey or Harry Potter.
You're a young lady. Yeah, you're not. You weren't Lady Edith or Lady Mary or Lady Sybil. I don't know which one you are. I see. I've seen you in a lot of things that you left no impression on me. In seriously, Prince of Persia.
Yeah.
What was she in the Prince of Persia? Like the princess of Persia,
the girl. Yeah. I don't know. Look, well, I'm sure it's a. If anybody has a drinking game for this show, like me recommending Tamara Drew is possibly one of them. But you know, I love her and I love that in that movie, and I love that movie. So
I'll tell you, seeing Prince of Persia and Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters makes me appreciate Tamara Drew in a way that I didn't in my first viewing.
Because she can do something.
So yeah, you know, it's on iTunes.
Okay,
check it. If you wish.
Before we get to the big movie of the week, I want to talk real quick about three major passings this week.
There have been Well, one just an hour ago.
One, yeah, one just is fresh. But first, Seijun Suzuki died.
Yes.
Who directed Tokyo Drifter and Brand to Kill. And yes. He's considered a real cornerstone of the Japanese New Wave.
Yes.
If you haven't seen either of those movies, check them out. They're great. And I'm sure those are the ones I've seen. But I hear his movies are generally like worth seeing and interesting.
Yes.
Our colleague Richard Schickel passed.
I didn't really know him.
I didn't know him real well.
I saw him at screenings all the time.
He sat next to me at a LAFCA voting meeting one time. Let's just say Mr. Schickel did not believe in self-censorship. Because people would throw out the things they were voting for, and he would literally just go, ugh. It was kind of great. It's like, you come sit next to me.
Did he ug you?
Probably. I don't remember, but he definitely
just looked at you like, why am I sitting next to you?
Probably, yeah.
Who are you, young man?
He got there late. That was the only reason he sat next to me. Usually he would have somebody cooler to talk to. But, you and I both grew up reading him in Time Magazine.
That is a fact.
And, you know, he produced a lot of stuff. Like, he did a lot of the...
I remember very specifically his review of Listomania. It's so stupid. But I was so on a high about Tommy
right,
that I was not having anyone who said that it was going to be bad, that Listomania was going to be bad, because I was damned and determined that somehow, some way, at age 12, I was going to sneak into an R-rated movie.
Starring that brilliant actor Roger Daltrey.
And see Listomania. And I did. But he did not care for that film. I read it in Time Magazine in the Rye, New Hampshire public library where I used to go after school all the time.
He produced a lot of documentaries. Like, he was one of the key people behind this thing called Life Goes to the Movies, which I remember watching on, like, it would pop up on Sunday afternoons on TV. It was a syndicated thing that was this kind of, like, you know, in a few hours sort of history of Hollywood. And I think a lot of my sort of at least kind of learning the basic timeline about, like, you know, silent films and then the, you know, depression, screwball comedy, gangster, monster movie, and then World War II, and then, you know, after the war in the 50s and the 60s. Like, shows like that really kind of taught me a lot as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I think he did a doc or either a doc or he was involved somehow in the restoration of Samuel Fuller's The Big Red One.
Right.
I knew he worked with Eastwood a lot on a lot of, like, his doc stuff and, you know, kind of like behind the scenes things. So he had a really fascinating career and was really enthusiastic about film. And so it's, you know, that's a loss this week. And then this morning we find out that Bill Paxton died. He was 61. He was in some complications from surgery, apparently.
What surgery was this?
I don't know.
They haven't said yet.
I haven't dug deeply enough to find out, but I'm kind of gobsmacked.
That was a shocker. Like, TMZ reported it. And I saw it pop up online within seconds.
Last night on Facebook, I saw somebody mentioned that somebody had tweeted that he had died and then immediately took it down because apparently the source was that fakey site that always puts celebrity deaths, you know, that never happened.
Right. But then TMZ got
morning. But then this morning, yeah,
and
it turned out.
You may not like TMZ, but they're always right.
They cover their sources.
Yeah.
Obviously we... You know, we're of the era of having seen him in stuff like, you know, Weird Science. And Aliens. I interviewed him for One False Move.
Yes.
Which is a great movie. And I had a great phone interview with him because I was writing for the Dallas Voice, the gay paper there.
Yeah.
And he's from Fort Worth.
Yes.
He is a Metroplex boy. And so he would tell me these stories about how he and his best friend would, like, go to the railroad tracks and shoot these movies, like these little amateur home movies.
Right.
He goes, like, one time they got chased out of there because one of them was wearing a Nazi uniform because they were doing a war movie. They're like 14. I thought that was kind of hilarious. And then, you know, he was also a musician. He wrote Fish Heads, right?
Yes.
And then he was in a band called Martini Ranch that had a song that I always liked called How Can the Laboring Man Find Time for Self-Culture? But he said in the interview that an acting coach he worked with said, look, you can do the music or you can do the acting, but you are not focusing enough on either one. So he ditched the music, and it his acting career kind of took off. You know, Big Love was great.
Yeah.
And I think that's a show that really you have to have a certain kind of actor that you are willing to follow into that character.
Yeah.
You have to really empathize with this guy.
Yeah.
Because the situation is on the surface so abhorrent.
Right.
You know, that he has these three wives. But Paxton just made that show work. I mean, not single-handedly. The whole show was great. But, I mean, he, without him, there's no show.
No, I know.
You know, he directed a film called Frailty that a lot of people have been talking about today that I hear is good. I've never seen it.
I never saw Frailty.
The one time that I met him was he wrote a movie and starred in it called Traveler with Mark Wahlberg about...
I did see that one.
Yeah, where they're Roma.
Long time ago.
You know, kind of like on the grift.
Yeah.
And that's a good movie. It's solidly put together. I think the guy who shot it was, or the guy who directed it was one of Eastwood's like cinematographers.
Uh-huh.
But Paxton, that's and all the time that I did the film festival, it's the only time somebody has just called the office and said, "Hey, you guys want to show my movie?" Or I should say somebody who you'd want to take that call from. I mean, yeah, a lot of people you have never heard of would maybe try that. But yeah, he just called the office one day. And so we showed it as the opening night film. He came, was super nice. Like when I posted the obit today on Facebook, everybody I know who worked at the festival that year was like, "Oh my God, he was the nicest guy."
He was the nicest guy, right.
Also, the first time I ever rode in a limo, it was with Bill Paxton. from the screening to the opening night reception.
Oh, I see.
So yes, R.I.P. Bill Paxton. He was great.
La La Land. I saw it again.
Oh yes,
the way you demanded.
Yes.
Let's revisit La La Land
okay.
for just a moment,
sure.
Because after today, I don't want to have to talk about it anymore.
Well, it's probably going to win Best Picture, which means that we will immediately forget that it ever happened.
Yeah. You were a little bit right.
Okay.
That I needed to see it on a big screen mm-hmm. rather than on the Academy Awards screener DVD that they sent us.
Yes.
It benefits from a big screen. It benefits from your full attention.
Yes.
Because, I'll be honest, when I watched it on the screener, in that middle slog section, I started to get a little bored.
You drifted off?
I didn't drift off. I didn't fall asleep or anything, but I just was distracted. I just thought, could they start singing again, please, instead of just getting grumpy with each other and having a fight? Answer, no. They did not start singing again in any way that made me happy.
I will agree that I think there is a flaw of the film in that it front and back loads all of its best numbers and then trusts the drama to carry the middle.
You're kind of right. It front loads the first two numbers. The first two numbers come bang, bang, and they're big.
Right, and then the third one is an intimate one, but it's also good.
Well, here, I'm going to tell you what I think.
Okay.
I think Damien Chazelle made a very specific choice
mm-hmm.
to give you macro that shrinks down into micro.
Mm-hmm.
So he begins the film with a huge production number.
Right.
An extravagant production number.
The idea being that Los Angeles is full of stories like these and full of people like this who have this desire to accomplish certain things.
To accomplish something.
And then we're going to focus now on these two.
And so conceptually, I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that he wants to take this huge sprawl
right.
of people and narrow it down to this story of these two folks who happen to meet and happen to fall in love.
Mm-hmm.
But they aren't interesting enough to me
really?
To carry that micro situation because their dreams are boilerplate. They are, she is one of, and the film shows you this.
Yeah.
She's one of hundreds, of pretty red-haired girls who want to be actresses.
Right.
And he is the white man in a world of jazz.
I resent this notion that white people aren't allowed to like jazz or participate in jazz.
You're just not. Okay. Are you going to... May I continue?
Sorry, I didn't mean to Dave White all over your explanation. Yeah. Go ahead.
The film has a problem sustaining my interest in these two people.
Okay.
And the final sequence, while I think it is very successful, it's not a number. It's a montage set to a recurring musical theme. They don't sing in the final sequence. It's all montage.
But it's not just montage of stuff we've seen. These are new moments. And
I didn't say it was montage of stuff we've seen. I said it's all montage. It's not a production number. It's not singing. It's not dancing. It's, well, there's some dancing.
There's some dancing.
There's a sequence where there's a lot of people dancing, but it's a confined space over pretty quickly. So as good as the ending is, and I do think the ending is really nice, I still need more singing and dancing numbers. I know it goes against what he has in his head about what he wants to be, but the films that he is influenced by, you know, Singing in the Rain and the French musicals,
yeah,
they're different sorts of films. You know, Singing in the Rain has big numbers throughout. Mm-hmm. The French films are small, intimate, and personal. They don't get huge, really.
Well, Cherbourg doesn't, but Young Girls of Rochefort.
Young Girls of Rochefort does once near the end at the show.
Well, but there's, I mean, think of the opening dance thing. There's all those people on that barge, and then later there's the thing in the plaza. I mean, so it goes back and forth.
Okay, but his approach is more intimate and realistic.
Okay, yes.
As opposed to the opening number, which is not intimate and not realistic at all. It's a fantasy.
Yes.
So I'm at odds personally with that decision. And that's not really anything that I can argue with Damien Chazelle about.
Right.
He did the movie he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I'm reviewing the film I wish I had seen.
Right.
You know. In that regard, on that issue, I just wanted more songs that involved more folks doing more things.
No, well, and I've said in my review, there needed to be at least, I think Gosling needs a boy loses girl number.
Yeah.
Just for balance. I think that part of the film needs another song.
And the race issue, this is a problem. But it's not the problem I think you think I'm about to tell you.
Then why don't you tell me?
I think it's a problem of obliviousness. Because if you want to get really specific about it, this film is chock full of not white people. However, they are mostly background. The only one who is not background is John Legend. And to the script's credit, John Legend has a sit-down with Ryan Gosling and says, "You're full of it.
Right.
You don't know what jazz is about. You just want to mine the past and recreate the past. I'm the one who's actually making the future of jazz.
Right.
You don't like what that future is because it's a fusion of funk and pop and all this other stuff that you find, you know, impure.
Yeah, you're Woody Allen.
but that's the way the world is. You don't have to like the world, but I'm doing the thing you say you want to do.
Right. Well, I just want to throw this in.
Yes.
The thing about the idea that there are people of color, but they're all background. Who in this movie, with the possible exception, besides John Legend and maybe Rosemary DeWitt, who's not Emma Stone or Ryan Gosling, has more than 10 lines of dialogue?
No one, and that is a problem. Again, that is a problem because it is a problem, again, let me say this very clearly, of obliviousness. There is absolutely a place for a movie about two attractive white people falling in love. Unfortunately, that place is every place. And there's this tiny little other space, a teensy tiny little place over somewhere else for the not white people movies. Okay? If we're going to complain about this problem, it needs to be addressed in the context of a film like La La Land, because La La Land is a significant film of this moment. Hear me out. If the movie were extremely bad, and it's not, it's a good movie. If the movie were inconsequential, with nobody paying attention to it, and it were still this sort of like obliviously white film, no one would be talking about it, because it wouldn't matter enough for people to talk about. We have to talk about this issue, and we have to push forward on this issue. And when I say we, I mean the culture. Hollywood needs to push forward on this issue, and we need to center this conversation around a film like La La Land, because La La Land is the big, shining, waving its hands in the air movie right now.
I take the complete opposite approach. Boom. I would rather be like, hey, why didn't anybody go see Southside with you? Why didn't anybody go see Queen of Katwe?
Yeah.
Why aren't people going to see these great films with black leads or people of color behind the camera, in front of the camera?
Yes.
And, you know, when they do go see something like Hidden Figures or whatever, hooray, and we should totally celebrate that.
Yes.
I don't think La La Land has to become the pillory of movies being too white because it happens to be a white movie. I don't.
La La Land is soaking up all the attention right now, and therefore that makes it a really great place to locate this discussion.
So basically, because it's on top of the pedestal, you want to throw tomatoes at it because it's sticking
out.
I'm
not throwing tomatoes at it.
But go ahead.
I'm saying that La La Land is the example of the kind of film that we see way too much of. And I don't mean musicals. I mean
movies about white
people. White movies about white people that are exclusive in their approach to race. I don't believe that the film positions Ryan Gosling's character as the white savior that
some have said.
He's arrogant enough. He's confident enough in his abilities that he thinks he can save, jazz from stylistic stuff that he's not interested in. But he doesn't think he has to save it from black people, because he's the only white guy in his own band,
right,
at the jazz club. And he needs those guys.
Yeah.
He praises those guys in the film. While talking to Emma Stone about why she's wrong to hate jazz.
Right. And then at the end, when he has his own club, he's still the only white guy.
He's still the only white guy.
I hear what you're saying.
But what?
My problem is to pin all of Hollywood's problems with race and with representation onto this movie that happens to be successful.
An unsuccessful movie wouldn't generate the dialogue. A successful movie generates the dialogue, and this perfectly sweet and charming film is, for better or worse, maybe you think it's for worse, but I think it's a perfectly valid location to start this conversation again, because it keeps getting started again and again and again, and it gets halted again and again and again. And because it's got all the heat and all the light and all the attention, it's a pile on, I know, but that's how you push things forward. By yelling about the thing.
See, I think I agree with you that it's a conversation needs to be had, and I'm all for yelling. I just don't think this movie deserves to be the crux of the argument. Again, why can't it be from the point of view of, hey, look, Rogue One, super diverse cast of, you know, people from Latin America and Middle Easterners and black actors and, you know, a panoply of performers, and didn't harm that movie's box office prospects in the slightest.
What are you saying?
I'm saying, can we find positive examples of movies like that? Movies like Hidden Figures, that is the highest grossing Best Picture nominee.
Yes.
Go for the stuff where, you know, where it where we're showing that these movies can connect to an audience, and that this should be the paradigm moving forward for films, rather than take a movie that its only sin is, I don't even know what. I don't know what the fix for La La Land is to not have it be in the crosshairs on this one. But I don't see why we have to make that movie, put that movie on the cross for the sins of all these other films and for an industry that has done wrong by people of color.
I'm very sad for you that this nice movie that you like is taking the whipping. Okay. But it is the umpteenth bajillionth movie of its type to be praised this way, and I understand the exhaustion. So, I'm sorry, La La Land, but you're the lightning rod, and that's the way it's going to be. It's already the way it is. I didn't write all those think pieces. They've been written already.
I understand, but I think the whole thing is garbage. Because here's the thing: you're saying the movie's getting this heaped at it because it's successful and popular and acclaimed or whatever.
And as such,
and
because of its approach to race, it acts as propaganda. Just like you read that April Wolf article about the film, and it's not that she was attacking the movie. The movie is about whiteness, and therefore it is political, and therefore it is very much like other propaganda films. It is a story about the way white people want to see white people.
I think this movie is being excessively pilloried for sins it has not committed.
I like this movie.
Well, I think
I like this movie, deserves praise, and it deserves this argument.
I think the pylon is garbage, and I think that there's a way to talk about these issues, and they need to be talked about. I totally agree with you, through other prisms. You know, talk about Suicide Squad, even.
Okay.
Which was, again,
well, we did.
But I'm saying, like,
and folks did.
But they didn't talk about the fact that it was a big hit movie that had, like, significant black and Latino and other non-white, characters.
Yeah, but it was steeped in stereotype and racism.
Look, I'm not going to defend Suicide Squad in the slightest.
Good, because you can't. Representation is not the same as quality.
Well, yes, obviously. But again, I want to go back to everybody who is writing one of these snotty little think pieces about La La Land, mm-hmm. and be like, did you cover Queen of Katwe? Did you send people to see Southside with you? Then shut up.
I don't think you can ever tell anyone to shut up.
I just did.
I think, well, okay, sure, you can.
I just think that we accomplish more celebrating the work of the people who are out there doing the stuff that needs to be done and that there should be more of, than complaining about
breaking down what needs to be broken down. That's not the same as complaining.
Well, look, if La La Land were actively racist, then yes. But I think it is at worst.
It operates within structural racism, and therefore,
as you said, 99% of the movies out there,
uh-huh.
and including movies that made more money and got just as good reviews as La La Land, and no one's going after them. I just don't see. I agree with you. The conversations that we had, I don't see why this movie is the focal point. That's my only thing. Glad you saw it again.
Bad luck for La La Land, I guess.
Yeah, well, Moonlight swept the Spirit Awards, and it's going to get something major tonight.
Oh, it'll get
at least Mahershala Ali.
It'll get something, Mahershala Ali or screenplay or something.
Yeah,
yeah. Cinematography. Is it nominated for cinematography?
It is.
Okay. It should get that.
Yes, totally.
Anyway. Get out.
I was say, speaking of movies and racism, or that deal with, you know, the
how
topic.
How do we talk? Okay. How do we talk about Get Out
without
talking about Get Out? Because
well, I'll tell you,
need to see.
Yes.
You need to see Get Out.
Yes.
And I mean, go now before people start spoiling the stuff for you.
And don't see the trailer, because the trailer totally tells you way too much.
Does it really?
Oh, yeah.
I never saw the trailer. I think I can talk around this in a very, we're not going to spoil it.
Nope.
But I think I can tell you what it's about without spoiling it.
Okay.
Daniel Kaluuya is the boyfriend of Allison Williams from Girls. He's black, she's white. She's taking him home for the weekend to meet her parents. He is nervous about this. She has not yet told them that he is black. This makes him even more nervous. She says, not to worry. My dad would have voted for Obama a third time if he could.
And he'll probably tell you that at some point this
weekend. Yes. This does not make him any less uneasy. They drive out there.
They hit a deer.
They get stopped by the police. The police start to treat Daniel Kaluuya in that racist way that police have been well documented to do of late.
They ask him for ID, even though she was the one driving.
Yeah.
She
defends him in a sassy-mouthed way, which makes him think they're going to get in trouble. But it doesn't happen because
she's white.
pretty white girl. They get to her family's house. It sure does look kind of plantation-y. It's upstate New York.
I guess.
They have staff at the house. A groundskeeper and a housekeeper, both of whom are black.
But the dad's very apologetic about this fact.
The father is apologetic about this. Bradley Whitford is the father. Mm-hmm. Catherine Keener is the mother. And then things get weird and weirder and weirder and more frightening and bizarre. And I'm not going to tell you anything about any of that.
This is the directorial and screenwriting debut of Jordan Peele, of Key and Peele.
Yeah.
And one of the great things about Key and Peele was its fearlessness in tackling uncomfortable subject matter about sort of uncomfortable divisions, whether it was about black and white or male and female or gay and straight.
Yep.
Nerd and cool, you know.
Yeah.
And so he, there's
all. This is about race.
This is super about race, and he tackles the discomfort, but rather than play it for laughs, he's playing it for tension and thrillerness.
How did you said in your you wrote the review and you said Stepford Wives was about...
Stepford Wives exploited liberated feminists' fear of male chauvinists' fear of liberated feminists.
Yeah.
And this movie tackles black people's fear of white people's fear of black people.
Yeah. Run those through your head second time.
Somebody quoted that to me yesterday at the Spirit Awards. Yep. I was very flattered.
It is an excellent movie. It is an excellent thriller.
Mm-hmm.
It has its basis in horror, and I don't want to sell the horror angle of it too much, because to me, horror should be really scary.
Mm-hmm.
And this is more
tense,
like a freaked out paranoid thriller.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that the most memorable scene for me in the film is steeped in horror.
Hmm.
And reminds me of my recurring nightmare. And I won't tell you what my recurring nightmare is. I've talked about it in the past, but it involves inevitability and being frozen in the moment of inevitability, mm-hmm. where I am frozen and I can see the thing coming, and it keeps coming and keeps coming and keeps coming and keeps coming, and I'm powerless to stop it. And right. it destroys me. There's a scene that literally does this in the film, minus the whole the person being destroyed at the end. But it's this scene of
you helplessness.
See, you see the thing coming and it's coming at you, but you're stuck.
Yeah.
And that scene is the theme of the film, because it's a slow inevitability in the film. And it's about knowing you're in trouble and not being able to move.
Right. It's a genre movie that has very sharp things to say about the world we live in. And a lot of times, movies that try to do that either bobble the basic genre stuff, like if it's a scary movie that's not scary, or it's a comedy that's not funny, or they bobble the messaging.
Yeah.
And this one gets both, like, spot on.
There's a
uses the messaging to drive the horror very frequently because of the specifics of the black experience in the United States as they are lived right now.
The performances are great. The direction and editing are great.
Yeah.
There is comedy in the film because this comes from a comedian.
Yeah.
But it's not intrusive. It actually really works within the context of the movie.
Yeah.
And it is so highly detailed. I wish I could talk about those details with you right now. But when you go, and you will go, pay attention to all the things that are around you, that are around the characters. Pay attention to the settings and the props and the and what people do and what they do with objects, and it's oh God. I cannot recommend this highly enough. Like I think that, you know, the year will come to an end and this will wind up on year end best lists.
Yeah.
Shockingly, because it's opening in February. But and on Oscar weekend of
But it's doing when really
no one
well.
Cares.
I mean, it's 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Is it still 100%?
It's still 100%. Last time I looked,
it's 83 on Metacritic.
Right. Well, that's, you know, I mean, I gave it a 90 on Metacritic. I mean, I don't love it, you know.
Right.
It's already my leading contender for the, you know, LAFCA every year does the New Generation Award.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, for sure, Jordan Peele.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, not going to tell you anything else.
Yeah, just go see Get Out.
I don't have a DVD pick this week because I didn't think about it. And let's just go to letters.
Fine.
Where are my letters?
Okay. Oh, before we get into letters, just a quick reminder to people. Linoleum Nights starts today.
Well, I mean, it's at 2 p.m. Sunday, and we messaged all the Patreon people.
Yes, and if you want in on that and on Linoleum Knife and Fork and LKTV and all the other shows that we do for our Patreon subscribers, you should become a Patreon subscriber. Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
The most cost-efficient membership levels do not get you Linoleum Nights.
Well, that's true.
But it gets you Linoleum. It gets you LKTV, the TV podcast. It gets you the new food podcast called Linoleum Knife and Fork. We are not chefs. It is a podcast where we talk about eating and my half-assed home cooking.
Yes.
There is no authority involved.
People seem to like it, though.
Why? I don't know, but... Like, I think of us as having authority in film criticism, and even in television criticism. Mm-hmm. We have zero authority.
We have enthusiasm.
Linoleum Knife and Fork. But perhaps you'll like to listen to that anyway. Yes, we do have enthusiasm. Yes, we do.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Hang on. I'm sorry.
After all that vamping, you still don't have a letter?
Well, I wasn't. You weren't vamping. I was. Okay.
We're also selling t-shirts.
No. Not later. Okay. Here's from Seth. I started listening to you after loving Alonzo's reviews on What the Flick.
Oh, thanks.
No matter if I agreed with him or not. My question, which probably won't get answered for a few months, that's everybody's new thing, right?
Ha, ha, ha.
Everybody's new jam is telling us, oh, we're not going to answer your question for 3 months. Well, this letter is only 3 weeks old.
So there.
How you like us now? I mean, there are letters that are older than 3 weeks that are sitting in the inbox, I know. Don't freak out on me, please. Okay. I've started USC Film School in January. And I wanted to know if you have some particular favorite smaller movie theaters that you would recommend in Los Angeles.
Speaking of USC, I just wanted to mention real quick, a quick shout out to the folks at Platform,
yes,
which is a show on the USC campus television. It's a panel show, and I guess on Fridays they talk about movies. They had me in this week to talk about film crematism in general, and then also about the Oscars, and they were great, fun guys, and fun lady, and interesting opinions, and I had a blast.
All right, favorite smaller movie theaters.
Well, CineFamily, of course.
CineFamily.
You know, the New Beverly.
The New Beverly. I like the Arrow. I like the Egyptian.
The Downtown Independent can be fun.
The Steven Spielberg inside. Hang on. The Steven Spielberg
theater
within a theater. At the Egyptian is a tiny little space where they show serious art film.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I don't know what size and shape you are, Seth, but I'm a big fella, and those seats are murder in there. So you need to be really into what you're seeing.
It's not about comfort.
At that place, because it is not about comfort at all.
You know, the Bing at LACMA is a good theater.
The Hammer Museum, yeah. UCLA.
The Billy Wilder Theater.
Yeah, the Billy Wilder Theater at the Hammer Museum screen stuff. I love the New Art.
Yeah.
I love the Royal. I love the Lemley Theaters.
Mm.
I love the Encino,
New Art is a landmark.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. I love the Town Center 5 in Encino.
Yes, right next to Waffles.
Right next to the Waffle Place. I love the Music Hall. You're guaranteed to be the youngest person there.
Yes. The only one who didn't bring his own oxygen.
I like the couch rooms at the Landmark.
Oh, those are nice. Upstairs, yeah.
Yeah.
If you can get a couch at CineFamily, it's worth the extra bucks.
Well, yeah, you have to pay extra for the couch at CineFamily, though. So, you know, go to those places. Just avoid the big multiplexes if you can.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you gotta.
Because, you have no choice.
The Sundance Sunset is nice.
The Sundance Sunset is nice. You can buy a lobster roll
there. After 5.
Are you, wait, is he's 20, are you 21? Because you can't go.
Oh, that's true,
21.
Yeah.
It's a 21 and over theater because they sell the booze.
Booze.
Yeah.
You will be carded.
Anyway, here's his top 10.
Okay.
2001.
Yeah.
The Graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Clockwork Orange.
Okay.
What's the... You don't really like The Graduate too much.
I'm not a big fan of The Graduate, but I understand its place in
cinema
history, so whatever. Ebert agrees with me, so shut up.
Empire Strikes Back.
Okay.
Up.
Yeah.
Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
Good Will Hunting.
Mm.
What do we think about Good Will Hunting?
Have you seen it since we saw it in its original release?
No.
I haven't.
And the only thing that I thought was interesting about Good Will Hunting was Gus Van Sant's obvious crush on baby Matt Damon.
Mm. Yeah, there's a definite male gaze situation happening there.
Yeah.
G-A-Z-E. Yeah, I'll give it to him, but I'm not.
No, I won't.
No?
No, I'm not into it.
Okay.
Moonrise Kingdom.
Okay.
Inside Llewyn Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
You're 90% knife.
95.
Seth. Oh, you're going to give him Goodwill?
I'll give him Goodwill.
Fine. You're 95% knife.
Seth. May I suggest more movies made before 1960?
You got to start somewhere.
Just throwing that out there.
All right. This is from AB Film Review. From Australia.
Mm.
Yeah. I recently joined the... Is there Andrew? That's his name.
Okay.
Andrew. I recently joined the illustrious lineup of fans on your Patreon.
Yay!
Have been eagerly devouring episodes. I'm writing to ask a question about Australian cinema and its representation around the world. After hearing Alonso discuss The Dressmaker and how he found the broad Aussie comedy didn't travel too well, it made me wonder how and why Australian cinema struggles to find an international audience. Because it stinks, that's why.
Oh, stop. Not true.
I kid. That was a little joke I just made. Granted, Australian audiences rarely go to see Australian films. Is that true? Australian audiences don't go see Australian films?
That happens.
Do I see more Australian films than you Australians?
And there are countries where that's a thing, where like no one's interested in the... They just want more, you know. I told you this story about when I took the new German cinema class in college.
Yeah.
And the professor was all like, well, you know, in Europe, they really treat film as an art. It's not like in America where it's all commercial, blah,
right,
blah, blah.
Right.
And this one guy raised his hand and goes, really? Because I did a semester abroad in Berlin and the lines for Police Academy Dry were around the block.
Well, you know, that's apparently a thing. Apparently the Police Academy movies were huge in Germany.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know why.
They like uniforms.
They also loved David Hasselhoff back then.
That's true.
In a big way. Like, he was a pop star over there. Like, he sang songs, and they were hit songs.
Well, you know, if any American movie star works in any language around the world, it's Michael Winslow.
Mm. All right. Australian audiences rarely go and see Australian films. We only seem to go and see Australian films once they've been validated by international audiences. Lion has recently had the highest independent opening in Australian history. The Australian films that I can think of that have had mild, broader appeal have had niche plots or themes, such as 52 Tuesdays or Animal Kingdom.
Mm.
Yes, Mad Max Fury Road was a massive success, but it hardly represents what Australian cinema can be.
Right.
It seems that many Australian films would be well received internationally if they were given a chance or had higher promotional funding. I will argue that Ivan Sen's Goldstone sits alongside No Country for Old Men or Hell or High Water in tone and would have greater audience appreciation if it had the chance. Where foreign language or British films seem to have critical or financial success internationally, Australian films seem to fall by the wayside.
Hmm.
I guess Animal Kingdom is maybe the last big Australian movie.
Well, Dressmaker was it
over here? Yeah, but it didn't get the traction that Animal Kingdom did.
I suppose. I think you could probably point to a lot of Australian genre films that didn't do that great here. Like the titles are escaping me, but I can think of like there's a bunch of westerns with Guy Pearce in them. You know, as being like movies that kind of open and don't really do anything. You know,
it's
a crapshoot. You know,
yeah, it is. I don't know the answer to what will make one of them hit outside the Australia and then back in turn
in Australia
become popular in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously distributors have a lot to do with it. Probably big international festivals, you know, if you get like a nice plum position at, you know, Cannes or Toronto or something, that can really like bring a lot of eyeballs to your movie. Yeah, I don't know. Cause I love a lot of Australian film. I mean, in fact, going back to our Patreon, our next LK Selector discussion is about Gillian Armstrong's Starstruck.
Yes, it is.
You know, and I think she's still one of the great living filmmakers. You know, she had that documentary about Ori Kelly last year that was so fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, I'm sure if you asked her, she would talk about having a hard time getting funding to make movies, you know. And so that's obviously where a lot of it comes from, too, is like, what's even... are there enough Australian filmmakers who are successful within Australia and not having to like come to the States and try to get funding there, you know? Because you look at like the original Australian New Wave, people like Fred Skepsy or Peter Weir, you know, a lot of them eventually came to the States because that's where the action was. Right. You know?
He says, if interested, here are 10 Australian films I feel are indicative of what we can produce. Lantana. Did you see that one?
I didn't. I remember it. But I did.
It was good.
Maybe I did.
Like 2000, 2001-ish.
Anthony LaPaglia.
Yeah.
I might have seen that one, actually, yes.
Welcome to Whoop Whoop, which I never saw.
I never did. That was Stephen Elliott's follow-up to Adventures of Priscilla. Yes. I heard very mixed about it, but there are people who love that movie.
Turkey Shoot, which I have not seen.
Don't know it.
Samson and Delilah, which I have not seen.
Don't know that one.
Breaker Morant.
Great movie.
Yeah. My Year Without Sex, which I did not see.
Don't know that one.
Proof, which is terrific. Oh,
love it. From the director of The Dressmaker.
Yep. Love Serenade. Did not see that.
I know of that one. I think Miranda Otto is in that. I've never seen it.
Charlie's Country and Goldstone. Again, have not seen
that. Don't know those.
So, yeah, I've seen the ones that broke out.
Yeah, you know? I mean, because in the 70s, we started getting like Breaker Morant and Gallipoli and, you know, Picnic at Hanging Rock and My Brilliant Career. And, you know, there was this, you know, the Australian New Wave was happening. I think it's, That's kind of the par for the course for a lot of countries where there's this sudden explosion of film for whatever cultural reasons, and then either they figure out how to get traction and keep things going in their home country, or they go to, you know, work in America because there's more money there, or, you know, it's hard to maintain that kind of thing. But, I don't really know what the specifics are as to why we aren't getting more Australian movies.
This is from Jordan.
Okay.
It's a little long. But we have like 5 minutes left in my time frame of podcasting today. So here goes. Hello, I'm the 15-year-old kid. He says, don't think there are many here. Actually, there are.
You'd be amazed.
Yeah. Hello, I'm the 15-year-old kid. You probably don't remember me. I wrote an email a couple of months ago in which I said that I liked Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. To which Alonso replied in his usual savage way, how old did you say he was again? In his usual savage way. Now, that's probably fair. Even though most teen movies don't hit me personally, this one did, mainly because it's about kids that like movies. Mm-hmm. Not just that, though. These kids like The Seventh Seal and The 400 Blows instead of Interstellar and The Imitation Game. It was my first ever advanced screening, and it transitioned me into the phase of my life where I try to watch a movie a day.
Whoa. Are there teens who are into The Imitation Game?
I don't know.
Anyway.
It was when I started writing movie reviews, a practice I continue to keep up with. On reflection, I see the issues, but it was the right movie at the right time, and I will stand by it.
Absolutely.
I guess it's similar to Dave and the guilt trip. I don't think I stand by the guilt trip.
No, but sometimes
I just stand by my
that moment.
My emotional response.
Yeah. Timing is everything.
It got me in the right spot at the right moment. Now I'm going to tell you why Nocturnal Animals is a horrendous piece of crap. Spoilers.
All right, then.
If you don't want to hear spoilers about Nocturnal Animals, then you can turn us off right now, because all we're going to do after this is tell you to join our Patreon, starting at $4 a month for LKTV, and higher up levels for more money after that, and to tell you to buy a T-shirt that's black with the words Linoleum Knife on the front of it for $22, payable to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
PayPal?
You want this shirt on your body.
And we've got all the sizes.
It will make you more sexually attractive to everyone in your life.
It's true. It's total catnip, this shirt.
Yeah. It was hard not to walk out of the theater. I was intrigued by the opening credits. It's hard not to be, I would say, but quickly lost interest in, as Alonzo would say, sad people in nice houses. As the slow scene of abduction takes place on the side of the road, I thought to myself, Amy Adams' character is reacting in such a way to this scene that tells me that this is based on reality despite taking place in a book. So Isla Fisher is going to be fine since she's the fictional version of Amy Adams. Nope.
Oops.
This took all the tension out of the scene, resulting in pointless and rather brutal violence against women that felt devoid of purpose. And then a shot of Amy Adams looking sad. Meanwhile, the script makes everyone talk very openly about their feelings, causing blatant and uninteresting storytelling. And on the subject of blatant, there's a giant poster that says revenge in the background. So now Tom Ford thinks I can't process what his blatant dialogue is obviously about. Thanks. I'm with you on this. I thought that was an actual Christopher Wool painting.
Right.
Because it is done in the manner of Christopher Wool, the artist, the very, very famous contemporary artist. Nope. This was Tom Ford
creating a
Christopher Wool-style painting just so he could have the word revenge on it. And that's not cool.
I'm sure he got an okay from Christopher Wool to do that.
Maybe he did.
Maybe he did.
Who knows?
You raise valid points.
There's more. We're not done. This film is also extremely melodramatic. Jake Gyllenhaal drops to his knees and screams, "No!" like 5 times. Tom Ford tries to be Lynch, Hitchcock, Cronenberg, fails to capture what makes each great individually because they're all so different. The score is basically a crappy version of the wonderful one from The Thin Blue Line. And then there's another shot of Amy Adams looking sad. Then we just get into stupid stuff. Amy Adams has an abortion, and Gyllenhaal's mad about that, so he writes his book, in which the parallel is that the rape and murder of his wife and child are equivalent to his wife having an abortion without telling him. Even if Ford isn't pro-life, it's just messy and convoluted. I get out of this dumpster fire, gladly trash talk about it with my Uncle Eric. My Uncle Eric, he wrote for MSNBC briefly, you might know him, and find all these critical praises, so I'm curious what their interpretations are. The first one I find is Tom Ford's. He says it's about, quote, a woman that has made the mistake of letting go of her true soulmate, and by reading his novel, it not only makes her fall in love with him all over again, it's a way of making her realize what she did to him. That's a quote from Tom Ford. Tom Ford. I'll be brief on the realize what she did to him part, because she's perfectly justified in having an abortion if she wants to, but this is the dumb part. Makes her fall in love with him all over again? Who the F falls in love with someone after reading them be a cynical, nihilistic bastard? Someone who has Isla Fisher, the fictional version of you, raped and murdered in the story. So basically, Tom Ford has no logic, and if you have a better interpretation than Tom Ford, please tell me. Love the show. You know what, Jordan? I like you. Say it.
This is all very salient, and I don't know that Tom Ford necessarily knows what Tom Ford's own movie is about. Not how I read it, though. I sort of saw it more as if anything, it's not the... it's not what she did to him, it's what she did to herself by giving up on art and instead going after money.
Yeah.
Like, that was my takeaway, was that it was making that she sort of realized the mistake that she made, and that while, yes, the book is obviously, you know, has violent intentions towards her or toward their life together or whatever, that for me, the standout was that he wrote it.
Yeah.
That he never gave up on his passion toward being a novelist, and that he created a work of art, whereas all she's done is sell other people's works of art. Yes, I agree. The revenge thing is super heavy-handed. I still thought it worked. I thought the novel sections of the film were really almost kind of peckinpah-ish, which is not a style I would have attributed to Tom Ford, but I thought that there was a real sort of raw energy to them. Mm. And I'm psyched that you know, if nothing else, Michael Shannon got an Oscar nomination because he's so good.
Michael Shannon is really good. Yeah. Otherwise, I've kind of mostly forgotten about this movie already.
I saw it in August, September, yeah. It hasn't stayed with me as much, I will admit.
No. Okay, we're done.
All right. Well, again, thank you to Blue, who I think does all the voices for our theme music. Go visit Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia, to find out more about his stuff. Go check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com and listen to the B-Movies podcast and Cancel Too Soon with Bibbs and Whitney, the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Matt and Gray, the Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Sewers of Paris, The Joel Ryan Thing, The Comics Canon, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at iTunes, and please leave us a review there. It does help. I sent you one.
Five stars.
You just shut your computer down.
Yeah, I'll read it next time.
We have a new 5-star review, so thank you for that. If you have not gone to review us, please do. It really helps. It helps a lot. You can also leave us positive feedback at all the places where we are streaming, like Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com, CastBox, Podbean, Satchel, iVooks, and Google Play, if you are on the Android. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. That's also the PayPal address if you want to buy one of our black t-shirts. And, of course, again, our Patreon is at patreon.com/linoleum.
I just told him all this stuff.
All one word. I'm just giving a quick recap. Shut your hole. Are we going to do a little post-Oscar?
Shut my hole.
Yes. Are we going to do a little post-Oscar thing tomorrow?
Why?
You brought it up.
I don't know.
We might.
Maybe we'll talk about it on LKTV or Linoleum Knife and Fork.
Well, no, that wouldn't
maybe be. Maybe we'll talk about it next week if we can remember what happened.
At some point, maybe.
Do you care? No one cares.
Look, you brought it up. I didn't think we were going to do it at all.
I didn't bring it up on the mic.
No, but now I am.
You're the one telling the whole world that I brought it up.
Well,
now
maybe,
off the microphone.
Maybe we'll do something tomorrow just for giggles.
Don't count on it.
But you don't know. I don't know. Anyway, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.